I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. He is a professor of environmental science and policy at George Mason University, and he is a senior fellow at the United Nations Foundation, and he will be speaking tonight at the James A. Little Theater at 7:30. His talk is titled A Wild Solution to Climate Change. It's sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute and part of their community lecture series. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you so much.
So you had an amazing biology teacher in high school. Tell us about that early experience.
So, you know, when I was going to the school, I was told you had to take biology in the first or second year. And with enormous prescience, I said, I'll take it the first year and get it over with. And then about 3 weeks with this teacher, he flipped my switch. And it was fascinating because he taught biology starting in September with blue-green algae and ending with mammals in the spring, and all other parts of biology were hung on in between. So before I was 15 years old, I understood the outline of life on Earth, which today we call biological diversity.
Which is a term that you really coined.
Well, I did. And it was just, we all just needed a term to refer to the collective variety of life on Earth.
Now, that term biological diversity, did that represent a shift in how scientists were thinking about the natural world?
Yes, it did, because there had been a lot of studies of species diversity of trees and birds and things like that. But the whole idea of thinking about diversity as a biological property, a property of ecosystems, or indeed of the entire planet, that was new.
I mean, it seems like thinking about ecosystems as a whole versus the individual creatures within them is such a different perspective.
Yeah, so biodiversity is both the structure and what makes ecosystems function. So it sort of put it all together.
Can you expand on that?
Well, so, you know, you look at any ecosystem, whether it's a dry land ecosystem here in Santa Fe, or you look at a pond somewhere, and there will be a whole set of characteristic plant and animal species as well as microorganisms in it. And there's a diversity of organisms, and that diversity is characteristic of that biological community. But at the same time, they're, you know, every second of the day, they're pursuing their natural history, you know, looking for food, releasing wastes, and all that collective activity is what makes an ecosystem function.
So you have been working in the Brazilian Amazon since 1965.
That's right.
And your early high school experience really got you outdoors, and you've kind of been in the field ever since.
Well, you know, I've just gotten worse ever since, right? I mean, I've just never been able to get enough of nature and of the variety of life on Earth.
So why'd you choose the Amazon?
I would have gone almost anywhere to have a biological adventure. And it just fell into my lap. In 1965, my freshman advisor at Yale, then at the Smithsonian, said, I think if you write a letter to Wilbur Downs at the Rockefeller Foundation, you could get the money to come spend the summer with me in the Brazilian Amazon. And I never looked back.
In your lifetime, the effects of industrial society and this wonderful world in which we're living on the natural world have been seen and are being seen in ways that probably nobody anticipated. Besides climate change, which we'll get to in a moment, what are the principal threats to species and ecosystems today?
Well, there's a whole set of activities, which is sort of over-exploitation of natural stocks. You know, the collapse of the cod fishery in the Northeast, for example. But there's habitat destruction. There's habitat fragmentation. There's pollution from all kinds of man-made chemicals. Distortion of the big global cycles of nitrogen and carbon, and the latter, of course, related to climate change. And they interact. That's only a bigger problem, is that they interact. You just don't add them up. They essentially reinforce each other in negative ways.
What are some examples of that?
So, I mean, take habitat fragmentation, which is pretty characteristic of human impact on landscapes wherever you are, that over time the natural pieces end up as little fragments in the landscape. So that's a problem in itself. I made a lifetime studying it. But they're also become more vulnerable to climate change when it comes along, in the sense that one of the first responses of species to climate change is to actually to move and try to track their required climatic conditions. And if they're living in a fragment in a sea of man-dominated habitat, basically there's just this huge obstacle course, and they can't actually track their required conditions, and so they're going to wink out.
And is it, for example, more difficult for mammals that have to travel across land than for birds?
In principle it is, but it all depends on the actual species. So things like, well, take the grizzly bear. It could roam all over North America before the major changes to the landscape. But now there are places where it's absolutely blocked by, say, an interstate highway. And so it can be really tough for mammals. Some birds can fly over it. Some will choose not to fly out into the open. And so in the Amazon, there are a whole set of species that live inside of forests. They like it dark, and they simply won't venture out into the open. So they can't move, whereas something on top of the forest, like a macaw, would just fly from one fragment to the next.
Now, you've written a lot about islands, and islands are not only physical islands, like an island in the middle of the ocean, but also isolated regions that become islands.
Well, and that's the other way of sort of describing habitat fragmentation, that you're creating these habitat islands in a matrix which is essentially an ocean of alien habitat.
And so do you see this in the Amazon, where there's so much, for example, clearing of forest and deforestation and cattle grazing and things like that?
Well, it's quite obvious in the Amazon, but it occurs almost everywhere humans are active. And there's probably not a county in North America that doesn't have some fragmentation issue.
So climate change is bringing about very great shifts in where species can survive. And so you see a lot of what looks like mass migration, not only of animals, but also really of plants. I saw a lecture that you did in which you were talking about basically sugar maples moving north, essentially.
That's right. So at double pre-industrial levels of carbon dioxide, if you want to see a sugar maple, you'll have to go to Canada. And even right now, you can actually go and see how Joshua trees are moving out of the Joshua Tree National Park. And just within the last week, a study sort of revealed that mangroves are marching north on the East Coast.
And so you have, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, all this northward movement, and you also have movement going up mountains.
Yeah. Those are the two generalities. It turns out there are plenty of exceptions to that, and so it gets complicated very fast.
What are some of the exceptions?
Well, it all depends on the configuration of the landscape, and some species move more easily than others. And so at the moment, we're just sort of seeing the beginnings of all of this, but what we really know is with greater climate change, basically entire biological communities and ecosystems won't move as a unit. They will actually move species by species, each in its own direction at its own rate. And essentially, they will come apart as ecosystems.
Because all those species depend on each other.
Well, that's right. And then in the end, they're going to reassemble in some kind of unimaginable ecosystem. So the bottom line here is the more climate change that takes place, the harder it is to manage it.
And meanwhile, we are talking continually about climate tipping points. We don't know which tipping points we've already tipped over, but as you have put it on more than one occasion, it's not really an experiment that you want to see how it comes out.
Well, that's right. I mean, I like to say that the the congruence between those who don't believe in evolution and those who don't believe in climate change is creating the greatest experiment in the history of life on Earth to prove natural selection.
Right. Which is, it must be painful. I mean, for you to have been doing all this work over the course of, well, more than 50 years, I mean, you are a scientist and you have to look at things as objectively as possible, and yet it must be, I'm projecting, emotionally harrowing.
Well, it can be really challenging, let's put it that way. On the other hand, there's so much that still can be done that there's plenty to get up and do every day to keep it from being worse than it would be otherwise. So optimism is the only option of choice.
So you've worked a great deal in public policy. You've worked with several presidential administrations and the UN, the World Bank, and many organizations like the World Wildlife Fund, the Smithsonian. You were one of the earliest employees at the World Wildlife Fund.
That's right. I became employee number 13 at World Wildlife Fund US in 1973.
Right. So what are some of the most effective public policies you've seen, and how did they get put into place?
Well, you know, a lot of them came in the 70s. There was a burst of environmental institution building and environmental laws that were passed. Interestingly, you know, in the Nixon and Ford administrations, essentially the creation of moderate Republicans. And so you had the Council on Environmental Quality and the EPA, but you also had the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, later amended in a good way, the Endangered Species Act, which is a very powerful piece of legislation, but more and more difficult to administer as the list of species gets long. So there are a whole series of laws like that which were quite visionary and quite effective.
Are there other public policies that, and Lord knows it's difficult in Washington these days to get anything done, but if they could be passed, would be also very effective that we don't have right now?
So, you know, I think the absolutely most important and simplest thing to do would be actually to put a tax on carbon. And that would mean people would use less of carbon, but it doesn't mean they would pay more taxes. It depends what you do with that revenue. It could actually reimburse citizens from taxes they are paying currently. But we just simply have to get carbon out of the economy.
If you had a tax on carbon, what do you think would be the sequence of events that would follow?
So, I think we would see an acceleration of energy efficiency. We would see an acceleration of renewable energy. We might even see some major innovations which would actually allow you to continue to burn something like coal, but have no CO2 come out of the chimney. So I just think it would put the emphasis all in the kind of direction we need to go.
When you tax carbon, whom exactly are you taxing?
So all you're taxing is the use of carbon.
So I get taxed when I put gas in the car, or? So,
well, yeah, when you put gas in the car, there will be, in the price of gas, there will be a carbon tax. And so your incentive to use a different kind of fuel is increased.
But if, for example, Exxon is passing that tax on to me and still making its mega profits, why would they have any incentive to not drill every last bit of petroleum out of the ground?
Because the volume of their sales would be dropping as you switch to forms of energy that are less carbon intense.
We're talking to Professor of Environmental Science and Policy, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. Now, what are debt for nature swaps?
So that sort of got started when I was in a hearing listening to the effects of multilateral development bank loans to highly indebted countries. And they actually were unintentionally creating environmental problems. And I simply thought, I wonder if you could turn it around and have it benefit the environment. And so that's first started actually about 1987, when there was a lot of indebtedness of Latin American countries, and you could buy their debt at a discount in the market. And so you'd cook a deal with whatever country was interested, and you'd buy their debt at a discount and sell it back to them at something close to face value, except they would redeem it in their own currency. So they didn't have a hard currency obligation. And then completely by pre-arrangement, it would go for some kind of conservation project that they would like to actually underwrite and didn't have the funds for.
So some small Latin American country owes $10 million that they can't pay back. And who would be the person who buys it? Or the
entity? So in the early days, it usually was a conservation organization that did it. As that kind of debt basically was progressively retired, then Debt for Nature switched over to government-to-government debt. So, for example, we recently did a $30 million Debt for Nature project with Indonesia to support the creation and management of some protected areas. And what that does is it gets Indonesia off having to repay us at any point, gives them a national environmental asset that they care about.
Who is in favor of those? I mean, it sounds like a great idea. And who is opposing them? Because, I mean, it sounds like something that every third world country would gladly do.
So there's some people who don't like the idea of forgiving a debt. There are people on the other side who would just like the debt to go away. So any kind of a deal is not acceptable. But by and large, they've been pretty well received. The biggest criticisms have tended to be around the details of individual projects rather than the actual financial mechanism.
Have there been a lot of these already?
Actually, we don't know how many. It's probably well in excess of 3 to 4 billion. They just, you know, they don't cease to be news anymore, and there's no central place where anybody keeps sort of track of it.
Another really big idea, and you'll be talking about this tonight at the lecture, is basically the idea of using nature itself, using ecosystems as one of the big tools to fight climate change.
So one of the best kept secrets of the climate change issue is that not all of the excess CO2 comes from burning, you know, oil and gas and coal. Some of it has come from 3 centuries of destruction of ecosystems and degradation of ecosystems, because they're all made up of living things, and all living things are based on carbon. So there is an amount of carbon up there from former ecosystems, recent ecosystems, which could actually be brought back before it starts really heating the earth. And you just do that through reforestation and restoring degraded grasslands and grazing lands, modifying agriculture to store carbon rather than leak it, and then you get greater soil fertility, whole series of things like that. And I believe that it's perfectly possible that we could avoid at least half a degree of climate change if we do this at scale.
And that comes out to something like, what is it, 50 parts per million?
Yeah, it's about 50 parts per million.
Which is a lot.
Well, it's a lot when you think that the pre-industrial level of CO2 was 280 parts per million, and that we've already made it to 400 parts per million, and probably a reasonable level of less disruptive change for the planet and ourselves would be 350 parts per million. So we could actually make our future a lot easier if we undertake this.
One of the things that is demoralizing for us who are kind of outside, well, nobody's outside, but we're observing all this. We're observing politics. We try to make our voices heard. And no matter what we do, and no matter how dire a threat climate change clearly is, the people who are drilling minerals out of the ground, oil, gas, and so on, don't seem to get it. And our climate negotiators don't seem to get it. And our politicians don't seem to get it. You've worked for presidential administrations. You've worked in politics in Washington, D.C. What's going on?
So, I mean, I do have to say there are some who get it. Right.
Right.
Happily, there are some who get it. You know, and Senator Whitehouse gets up on the floor of the Senate and gives a climate change speech once every week. Right. But I really think most of these people don't have a clue of the importance of all of this. And one way I like to put it is, you know, if anybody had ever gotten up on the floor of the U.S. Congress and suggested we raise the level of the oceans, they would have been carted off to some kind of institution. And yet here we are doing it. You know, the oceans are roughly half a meter higher than they were before all of this. And you can see the effects in a place like Manhattan after Hurricane Sandy. And it's like, hey, wait a minute. Shouldn't we be doing something? And there are just so many people who talk past it or don't want to hear it. I mean, I would hate to think what their children and grandchildren will actually think of them. And maybe that's what's going to wake them up, is when more young people start pushing for a better future.
Yeah, coming home from school and telling their parents what they learned that day.
Well, it's true. I mean, I'll never forget in the first energy crisis when my kids told me they thought I was driving too much. One of my most acute memories of embarrassment and shame in my life.
Have you done calculations on, and I know, I mean, there's all kinds of innovations that we haven't invented yet and things like that, and maybe we'll find a way to do energy storage so we can be 100% wind and solar and so on, but is there a kind of sense you have of what world consumption per population is sustainable?
So we're talking about energy?
Yeah.
So I don't have a number to put on that, but people have sort of figured that out. And the important way to look at that is not as a limitation, but as a real framework within which to innovate and find ways to get the goods and services that people really would like to have. So innovation has an important role to play here, but not blind faith in innovation, right? That somebody will come up with something. People actually have to be working on it. So I think, you know, something akin to the Manhattan Project, but focused very tightly on solving this energy challenge, makes all the sense in the world.
It seems like such a, I don't know, a paradox or a catch-22, because we are all, or many of us, I mean, I know there's tremendous gaps of wealth and poverty, but so many people are living really more comfortable lives than Renaissance kings and queens. We have central heating. We can go wherever we want to. We can talk to each other across continents. All of these things are manifestations of the same system that's causing our demise.
Well, that's completely true. It just has to be sort of modified so that it doesn't have the downsides.
So what is lost when we lose species? You've written a great deal about extinction and predicted the extinction rates that are now coming true. Not only do we lose cute, fuzzy little things or food sources, but we lose a great deal of knowledge.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because the point that is rarely made is how important new insights into biological systems are to human advancement. And, you know, would anybody ever have imagined that metal beam architecture, you know, with all the skyscrapers in the world dependent on it, actually came from studying the structure on the underside of a giant Amazon water lily?
No way.
It's absolutely true. You know, Sir Joseph Paxton did that and became the basis for the design of the Crystal Palace at the London Exhibition of 1851, to which all metal beam buildings actually trace.
What are some other examples like that?
So basically, you know, in any room, probably almost the entire group would not be there except for advances in medicine based on a species that had previously been considered obscure, useless, or not even known. So high blood pressure treated with ACE inhibitors goes back to the biology of a nasty viper in the New World tropical forests. There's a Nobel Prize winning reaction called the polymerase chain reaction, which modifies genetic material, magnifies genetic material, and that has been the basis for a lot of revolutions in forensic medicine and diagnostic medicine, made the whole human genome project possible. I mean, one economist friend of mine put a value on that of having to be at least $1 trillion worth of value. So basically, it's really important to also think about nature as this gigantic living library about which we can learn things of immense importance to ourselves and advance the life sciences and our own sustainability.
And in addition to being a giant living library, it's also absolutely essential to our economy.
Well, you know, the provision of ecosystem services to the way we live is, you know, it's not counted in the economy, but it's there every day. And so I love to tell the story of the New York City watershed, which when I would come home from college, the water, I taste the water. Oh, my God, this is so good.
Yeah.
And then in the 90s, the watershed had deteriorated to a point that the Environmental Protection Agency was going to require construction of a water treatment plant at $8 billion. And the head of EPA Region 2, who happened to have the same biology teacher as I did, bought the idea that it would be a much better solution to restore the watershed and let the biodiversity do that function, and that it would be a permanent solution and a cheaper solution. And that's what they did, 10% of the cost.
It really underlines the importance of, I mean, to put it most simply, going outdoors. I mean, the wonder that you experienced as a young person, and perhaps still do to this day, is central to an understanding of how we can go forward.
You know, if I had the ability to have one wish granted, it would be to give everybody that opportunity on a regular basis to get outdoors and to understand what we share this planet with and what it means to us.
Dr. Thomas Lovejoy is a university professor of environmental science and policy at George Mason University. He's a senior fellow at the United Nations Foundation, and he will be speaking tonight at the James A. Little Theater at 7:30. His talk is titled A Wild Solution to Climate Change, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. They're on the web at santafe.edu. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.